our trip to Michigan. Oh, you can go ahead and talk right now. Before we went on our trip to Michigan, I don't even remember what I was doing, but I just heard like the scripture that I knew, which is one of my favorite scriptures anyway. And then I heard this, like this dialogue. And of course I knew it was from the Lord. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't hearing voices. So I knew it was from the Lord and I was like, oh my goodness. Okay. And in my spirit, like God didn't tell me you need to, you know, speak this to the women for the conference. Da, da, da. But in my spirit, that's, he gave me that feeling in my kishkas that I knew that that was what it was for. But obviously this message isn't just for people who are going to the conference, because this message, as you'll hear, is something that is really relevant to all of us, and something that if we can really get this just deep down inside and really grab a hold of this, which is something that we need to on a daily basis, that it will change us and how we look at our lives, and it will change those around us, because that, you know, what is birthed in us overflows to others. So, oh, my pages are on page 2. There we go. From the time we are young, we view ourselves in comparison to others, especially as women, right? First thing on the playground, all the little girls get together, compare their outfits, talk about what they like, what they don't like. It's how we as women especially are. We're always comparing ourselves to others and to others' standards, and we're plagued by this desire to fit in and to feel like we're up to snuff, and we're trying to be what we think we're supposed to be, right? And now it's like to the umpteenth degree. Now we have, I don't know how many of you are plugged into social media, but for, I know Brooke and I are, I can speak for me and Brooke. You go on Instagram, well, my pictures are great, but they're not as great as those person's pictures. And look at that kid in that, bathed in that natural sunlight, reading their book, looking so serene, sitting in their family room. And that's the picture of somebody's kid on Instagram. And you're like, man, my kid's got peanut butter in their hair and they're running all around the place and there's dust bunnies everywhere. There's no natural light. I'm lucky if we have lights on and clothes on and whatever. So this whole comparison thing just doesn't leave us. We're just constantly plagued by this. So what happens is it becomes this huge distraction, right? We're no longer focused on what God wants us to do or what direction we're headed. We're constantly focused on how we're not fitting in, how we're not measuring up. And then we are left feeling inadequate. And we say, well, I can't do that God wants me to do until I fill in the blank, until I'm more educated, until I'm better, until my kids are older, until I'm skinnier, until I put on weight, until I look like this, until my hair is not gray, until, you know, whatever. We feel like we can't do these things until we reach that perfect, whatever it is, that thing that we feel we're lacking in. So Romans 12, Paul talks about how we're called to do something in the kingdom of God. He says, if you're called to serve, then serve. If you're called to do this, then do this. If you're called to do that, then do that. So we know that we're all called to do something, but we disqualify ourselves from that. We say we're not ready for that. We're not, you know, I'm not there yet. We haven't arrived. So I want to introduce you to a few friends of mine. And they're old friends, really old, they're dead. First one is a guy who was spoiled. He was very pampered when he was young, grew up in a palace, had everything he ever wanted. He didn't grow up, though, among his people. He grew up, he was, you know, adopted into another group of people. So he wasn't amongst the people, but he didn't know any better, right? I'm sure he kind of maybe heard about it, but he grew up amongst the people he didn't know. He wasn't groomed to be a leader, right? He wasn't, there was no plan in his life for him to lead any big group of people. And this guy really had a temper too. And we can see that. He really had kind of a hair trigger temper. He did things before he thought about them. And that's something that really followed him throughout his life. But despite all those things that, you know, you say, those are not qualifications for doing some major things, right? Well, this guy was called to lead out the nation of Israel from the promised land, Moses. Man, that guy had a temper. I was talking to, who was I talking to? Maybe it was Jude. And I had prepped one of the Shabbat school things, and they were learning about the golden calf and what happened when Moses came down from the mountain and saw the golden calf. And, you know, it's one of those stories where you know it, you don't really, you kind of skim over it when you get to that section of the Bible. So when I was prepping it, in the kid notes, it had talked about how he smashed the golden calf, threw it in the fire, then took the pieces of gold, had them scattered in the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. And I was like, whoa, that's a whole new level of anger, right? That's not like he just got angry. And when he talks about it again, when it comes up again in Deuteronomy, he doesn't mention that when he retells it to the younger generation of Israel. He kind of leaves out that fact. Maybe he wasn't a little proud of how far he went with his anger, but that's what he did. I mean, that's like vindictive, right? Like, you want this? I'm going to make you have it inside, you know? So that was not really like, that's not listed in Seven Habits of Highly Effective People or How to Win Friends and Influence Others. You know, that's not something that's a qualification for leadership. But this is a guy that God called to be a leader, to lead this ragtag, complaining, horrible. You do not pick the guy with the temper to lead out the people who are complainers, right? You should have picked Aaron, because Aaron was really docile, right? Aaron was like, listen, you know, the people of Israel wanted a golden calf. Okay, well, just calm down. I can just see him. Just calm down. Okay. All right, you want a golden? All right, well, bring me your gold. All right, well, Moses isn't going to like this, but okay, you know. Well, that's exactly why Aaron wasn't picked. That temper that Moses had really, even though it worked against him in a lot of ways, it was also in his favor. But let's go to Exodus 3:11, because we can look back and see all the ways that Moses, his things that disqualified him for leadership also were good things too. But Moses didn't really see that. So God comes to Moses in the burning bush, which Jude mentioned today in the message. And, you know, I'd be like, oh my gosh, whatever is saying from that bush, I am going to listen to that. And God speaks to him out of the burning bush, and he says, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to lead the people out of Israel or out of Egypt, and you'll worship God on the mountain. And verse 11, the first thing Moses said is, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Okay, why are you talking back to God? You know, what, like, I'd be like, whatever, God, whatever you want. I don't know how it's going to happen, but sure, whatever. But no, his feeling of inadequacy superseded that moment where he was standing in front of a holy God in a burning bush that wasn't, you know, being burned up. His feelings of inadequacy were so immense. If we go to chapter 4, verse 1, God's been talking all throughout this time. Moses, you're going to do this, you're going to. God, I promise you, Pharaoh's not going to let you go, but then I'm going to do that. I'm going to strike these wonders and miracles. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you? Like, okay, God, I hear you're going to do all these things, but what if nobody believes me? You know, Moses was an outsider. He wasn't part of the nation of Israel. He hadn't grown up with them. Aaron did. Aaron makes sense as the person that should have been the one to lead the nation out. If you think about it, Aaron was already part of the nation. They knew him. He was one of their brothers, you know, cousins. Moses wasn't. Moses probably looked more Egyptian than he did Hebrew. So he says, what if they don't listen to me? And the God's like, don't worry, I got this. I'm gonna do signs. Throw your staff down. Look, it's a snake. And Moses says, verse 10, oh Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. So, okay, Lord, maybe I can do these signs and wonders. You'll make the snake, the staff a snake. But what am I going to say? You know, he wasn't groomed to be a public speaker. And then in verse 13, oh Lord, please send someone else to do it. How many times have we said that? Lord, you stall, right? Like your kids stall. They just kind of look around. Maybe if I don't say anything, Mom will forget she told me to do that. Lord, please send someone else. Mom, please make somebody else do the laundry. I mean, that's what we're all guilty of. Please, Lord, I don't want to do that. That's uncomfortable. He's trying like all the angles here. We go to chapter 6, verse 12. But Moses said to the Lord, if the Israelites will not listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me since I speak with faltering lips? God, if he didn't hear it the first time. By the way, I can't really speak that well. So Lord, please, maybe somebody else. And God just keeps telling him all these things that he's going to do. And Moses in verse 30 says, since I speak with faltering lips, why would Pharaoh listen to me? The same arguments. How many times are we giving God the same arguments? God, I'm too busy. God, I'm not ready. God, I'm not trained. God, I don't have time. Right? And God keeps telling us all these ways that he's going to take care of it. He's going to handle it. He just wants us to do it. We just have to be the conduit. And we're like, but I don't know. So finally, Moses seems to get to this place where he's like, I guess God just wore him down. And he just realizes God is not going to send somebody else. It's him. He's it. But then you see in chapter 14, Exodus 14, verse 13 and 14, all of a sudden now he's been through all the plagues. He's seen God working. He's seen how God has really come through in a way that he really didn't believe it would happen, okay? And maybe this gave him confidence that he saw that in spite of all of his inadequacies, God was at work in a powerful way. They've crossed the sea, or they're about to cross the sea, and the people are freaked out. And Moses says in verse 13 of chapter 14 in Exodus, Moses answered the people, do not be afraid. Stand firm and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still. This is a very different Moses from the Moses we saw starting in chapter 3. This is a Moses that has now learned that God is going to do the work. We're not going to do it. God is going to do it. And now he's sharing that with the people. He says, just be still. God will take care of it. So that's one example. And I want to tell you another favorite one of mine, because this one is just, I think this one's great. There was a guy who was a real scaredy cat. How many times does something come in our path? And in this situation for this man, it was a battle and people he had to fight. But we have that all on a different scale in our lives. You know, we're not living in the midst of a war zone, praise the Lord. But we still have battles that we have to fight, people that come against us, situations that seem insurmountable. And so many times we just want to like go home and close the door and hide, right? You don't want to face it. You don't want to deal with it. And sometimes you're forced to. God just shoves you out there. Other times he'll let you hide, but it doesn't. The situation doesn't go away. So my man Gideon, Judges 6:11. I love Gideon. And I love how God presents this story, because in Judges 6:11, the angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abizrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. So Gideon's like hiding. He's hiding his stuff. He's hiding from the Midianites because, excuse me, they had taken over the nation of Israel. And the Israelites were just like very oppressed at this time. So when the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, the Lord is with you, mighty warrior. But Sir Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all his wonders that our fathers told us? And what the, when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian. So has God ever come to you and said, hello, beautiful? And you're like, I'm not beautiful. Look at this flabby skin and these saggy wrinkles, right? We just don't see ourselves the way God sees us. The first thing that the angel of the Lord says, mighty warrior, he calls Gideon. Gideon had never seen a day of battle. He was not mighty. He was anything but mighty or a warrior. But God saw Gideon that way. But Gideon just went in one ear and out the other. Gideon immediately, but God, what you said, and this didn't, and I told, and what did I, right? Because Gideon did not see life the way God saw it. Verse 14, the Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? Gideon had no strength. The strength was from the Lord and from the fact that God was sending him. But Gideon doesn't realize this. Immediately he says, but Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh and I am the least in my family. He came from the smallest tribe, the weakest clan, and he was the weakest, probably lowest on the totem pole in his family. He was nothing. And God is telling him he's going to save Israel. God, there's a guy over there. He's much more suited for this than I am. Right? How many times is it? God, you know that lady at synagogue? She's really spiritual. She can do the Bible studies, Lord. Not me. Not me, Lord. I don't know anything. Right? The Lord answered, verse 16, I will be with you and you will strike down all the Midianites together. Gideon replied, if now I have found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it is really you talking to me. So he stopped with the excuses, but then he says, but I'm not really sure. Maybe I'm not hearing right. How many times? I've heard so many people say this. I'm not sure if I really heard God. Right? If you think you might have heard God, you probably heard God. Because really the doubt is usually just you. You just didn't maybe like what you heard from God. Right? You didn't like what you heard. It didn't sound plausible. It didn't make sense. So you said, God, if that's really you, and I've known people that will, like, this goes on for years with them. Well, I'm not sure, so I'm just going to pray about it a little longer. How long have you been praying about it? Well, 2 years. 2 years. Well, God spoke to you 2 years ago, and it's taken you 2 years, and you still don't believe him? But God, thankfully, is merciful. So Gideon asks for a sign. He says, please do not go away until I come back and bring my offering and set it before you. So he probably thought he saw a mirage. He was probably like, I must be hallucinating, right? And the Lord said, I will wait until you return. Gideon went in, prepared a young goat, and from an ephah flour, he made bread without yeast. I can tell you right now, that was probably a good 20 minutes. Putting the meat in a basket and its broth in a pot, he brought them out and offered them to him under the oak. So now he's okay, like the guy's still here, all right. The angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on this rock and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. So now he's got a soggy wet mess on the rock. With the tip of the staff that was in his hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread, and the angel of the Lord disappeared. Whoa, hello, that would have gotten my attention. My soggy, wet mess of food that I made for this guy who came from nowhere has now burnt up immediately, and the guy immediately disappeared. It's creepy. Gideon realized it was the angel of the Lord, he exclaimed, ah, sovereign Lord, now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. He was probably freaking out because the Lord said to him in verse 23, peace, do not be afraid, you are not going to die. So at least Gideon had the wherewithal to realize that, yes, this was the angel of the Lord. So Gideon built an altar to the Lord there and called it the Lord is peace. To this day it stands in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. That same night, the Lord said to him, take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old, tear down your father's altar to Baal, and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on the top of this height, using the wood of the Asherah pole that you cut down. Offer the second bull as a burnt offering. So now God's telling him, now you've got to step out and do something, something uncomfortable. You need to tear down the altar that your father has built. You have to take your father's bull, kill it, build a new altar, and sacrifice that bull on the altar. Going against daddy. And he was the worst, the smallest in the clan. He didn't have the chutzpah to go against dad. But he steps out there a little bit. So Gideon took 10 of his servants, strength in numbers, and did as the Lord told him. But because he was afraid of his family and the men of the town, he did it at night rather than in the daytime. I think I probably would have done that too. And the thing that I find comforting in this story is that, you know, God sees Gideon as his mighty warrior, and Gideon's on that journey to being that mighty warrior. He is certainly not there, but he's taking baby steps, and God is patient with him. You know, God isn't getting angry with him that he's not doing it during the daytime, that he's not confronting his dad and his clan right away. God is patient with Gideon for doing that. So now we're going to jump to verse 34. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, summoning the Abiezrites to follow him. So now Gideon is taking on that role because he's allowed the Spirit of the Lord to come upon him. Okay. However, still not a complete transformation yet. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, calling them to arms and also into Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, so that they too went up to meet them. Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand as you have promised, look, I will place a wool fleece on the threshing floor. And so he goes through the part where he sets out the fleece. Lord, just give me a sign. God gives him the sign. He goes, okay, well, maybe that was a fluke. Let's flip it and give me another sign. And God's like, all right, all right. And so Gideon has had all of these signs, and still he's unsure. We see in chapter 7, verse 7, the Lord said to Gideon, with the 300 men that lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. Let all the other men go, each to his own place. So Gideon sent the rest of the Israelites to their tents, but kept the 300 who took over the provisions and trumpets of the others. Now the camp of Midian lay below him in the valley. During that night, the Lord said to Gideon, get up, go down against the camp, because I'm going to give it into your hands. If you are afraid to attack, go down to the camp with your servant Purah and listen to what they are saying. Afterward, you will be encouraged to attack the camp. So that's what he did. He was still afraid, and God knew he was still afraid. But God is continuing to encourage him. And this is what we need to understand and know, is that when God calls us to do something and we don't feel adequate to do it, what he wants us to do is he wants us to step out in faith. And he's going to supply everything, and he's going to be gracious and merciful enough to be patient with us in our fear, in our inadequacy. But as long as we continue to walk down that path that he wants us to walk down, he's going to be continuously encouraging us and lifting us up and dragging us sometimes if necessary, but he will be there. And the last guy I want to talk about is my good friend Paul. So misunderstood. Paul was so intellectual. I read through Paul's letters in the New Testament, and I'm just like, I got to read that one sentence again, like three more times, because that one sentence, there's so much in it. I just can't absorb it yet. And you know why Paul was so intellectual and intelligent? Because he was just probably plain smart to begin with. But if we look in Philippians 3, 5 through 6, he's talking about, basically he's saying, you know, look, if anybody's got cause to boast, I do. He was circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, in regard to the law of Pharisee, as for zeal persecuting the church, as for righteousness based on the law, faultless. So by his own account, he had his stuff going on. He knew what he knew. He had studied under the famed rabbinical scholar Gamaliel. He knew his stuff. I mean, that man had Torah memorized backwards and forward. He could elucidate everything. I mean, I can't even comprehend, you know, what he forgot in the entirety of his life. I could never even know is how much this guy knew. And God used him in mighty ways. But, and you'd say, well, why are you talking, you know, we're talking about people who were not made for what they did. So why are you bringing up Paul, who was like perfect? He was like the perfect guy to go and preach. But Paul had his own issues, because all of us, you know, there's those people that I'm going to call them Pinterest perfect. Who knows what Pinterest is? Does everybody know? Okay, so Pinterest is kind of like your public bulletin board. And I love Pinterest because I'm a visual person. So like if I see something online that I want to be able to go back to later, like a recipe or something or a craft project, you can do what's called pin it. You can pin it to your Pinterest board. So I have all these different groupings of websites that go in, and it's all online. It's all virtual. So I can go back to it, and what shows up on my board is pictures. So it'll be a picture from that web page, which, you know, that pot of soup that I want to make someday. So for me as a visual person, that's really great, because I flip through and I go, oh yeah, that was the pot of soup I wanted to make. But people pin so many things. Like, I have so many things pinned, I will never in my lifetime get around to doing all the things that I have pinned. But just in case, someday, if I am left with all the time in the world, it's there, just in case. Pinterest has become one of those things that people are trying to live up to. Those, you know, I go on other people's Pinterest board, and I go, oh, look at all that beautiful stuff. Oh, I'll never be able to do all that. So it can easily become, if you don't have the right perspective, one of those standards that you're trying to live up to. Paul was Pinterest perfect, man. He had it all going on. He had the right pedigree, the right family, the right rabbinical teaching, spiritual stuff. He had everything. But all those people that we look at on Pinterest or Instagram that look perfect, those ladies with the children bathed in sunlight, right? You don't see their private moments. And that's the thing about social media and computers and Facebook and all that stuff. You only see, and even before technology, people only see what we put out there. And this is why people come to me and they're like, oh, your kids are so great and you and your husband are so wonderful. And the first thing out of my mouth is, we're really not that great. You know, not because I want to be like a Debbie Downer, but I've had so many people, not here, but in our previous synagogue, so many people say to me, other moms, I wish my kids were like yours, or I wish if only my husband was like your husband. And I want to knock that idol down, because I am not Pinterest perfect, nor are my children, and nor is my husband. And I don't want to be a stumbling block to you. What you don't see is you don't see all my crazy that gets hidden really well because I put it together and slap some makeup on a Shabbat, right? Although there's not as much on today, ladies. You can tell it's a rough morning when I got my glasses on, because usually Saturday is my contacts day. It's the one day of the week where I'm like, I'm going to put the contacts in, the eye makeup's going to be on, and woo, we're going to rock it out. Not today. It was like, I got to get out the door, I got to make sure we got this and 20 other things. Glasses are good. And I hope I put on enough hairspray that you can't see how greasy my hair is today. So, but that thing is that you look at somebody and you think that they've got it all together. And that's the standard you're setting up. That's the idol you're setting up. Well, I will do what God is calling me to do. Because God has told you, I want you to do this. You've had your burning bush moment with the Lord. And you thought you heard him, but you're not sure, and you're kind of putting him off because you go, but God, Susie over here, did you see her kids? They were dancing in the dance line at synagogue. Oh, it's so amazing, Lord. They're so wonderful. And God, once I get my kids in order, then I'll do that other thing you asked me to do. But that's not what God asked you to do. God didn't say, listen, when your kids are like Susie's kids, then once you come back to me and I got this thing over here I want you to do. No, God asked you to do something. And God knew your kids weren't like Susie's kids, and God knows what Susie's kids are like at home, right? And God is asking you to do that now. So Paul says in 2 Corinthians 12, 7 through 10, therefore, in order to keep me from becoming conceited, because Lord knows he was Pinterest perfect, right? I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger of Satan, to torment me. 3 times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. So we don't know what this thorn was in his side. We don't know what this messenger of Satan was. Maybe it was a mental thing that he was dealing with. Maybe it was an actual physical thing that he was dealing with. We have no way of knowing. But everyone, no matter how perfect they look, has something that is not going right. Something. And that something reminds them that they're human. And it reminds them that they can't do it without the Lord. And it reminds them that they are not that great. Right? We're not that great. Me, my something is, I got a lot of somethings. I'll tell you some of my somethings. Migraines. I got a migraine now. I started having a migraine this morning. Back pain. I've been in 2-3 car accidents, 2 rear endings, another car accident. I'm in constant back pain. Sometimes it's worse than others. But that's my thing. And people are like, oh, you really should pray. If you just pray to be healed, God will take it from you. And I'm like, yes, he may. And he may someday. But right now, that's my thorn. And I'm okay with that because God uses that to remind me that I can't do everything. And that is a reminder. There are days when I'm like, I've got this to-do list a mile long, things for synagogue, things with the kids, all my Pinteresty things. We're going to do our addition flashcards today, Micah. And then, boom, I get a migraine. I'm like, Micah, just go play. Mommy's going to lay down, close my eyes. And I'm reminded that all of my plans, all of my things that I think I'm going to do are nothing because God is the one in control. God can take away that migraine today, or God can choose to leave it with me because maybe my plans were not what he had for me today. Maybe his plan for me today was to take a nap because he knew I really needed that, not to work on my to-do list. So we have to surrender that to him, and we have to realize that the weaknesses are the opportunities for the strength of God to come in. And I want you to see that Paul was in good company. You can put up the next slide, Brooke. Jacob was a cheater. Peter had a temper. David had an affair. Noah got drunk. Jonah ran from God. Paul was a murderer. Gideon was insecure. Miriam was a gossip. Martha was a worrier. Thomas was a doubter. Sarah was impatient. Elijah was moody. Moses stuttered. Zacchaeus was short. Abraham was old. Joseph was prideful. Esther was an orphan. Lazarus was dead. But all of these people were used by God. All of them had weaknesses. And like Paul says that the Lord says, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. God doesn't use perfect people. And then Paul goes on to say, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Messiah's power may rest on me. That is why, for Messiah's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong. So yes, God can take away my back pain and he can take away my migraines, but I am happy for now that I have them until he sees fit to remove them because they remind me of my insufficiency and his grace and his power. That I can say, despite the fact that I had a migraine for 2 days and I had this and I had that, that I still accomplished all those things in the strength of the Lord. Because it is not me. And that reminds me that it's not me. Our weaknesses remind us that it is only God who does these things in us. So when we say, God, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not the other, he says, perfect! You're exactly the right candidate. All those things that you think disqualify you are actually things that qualify you to do this job that I want you to do. All right. Whew, I love it. Okay. 2 Corinthians 4, 7 through 9. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. Now, I haven't been persecuted lately, but I have been hard-pressed on every side. I've been perplexed. God, why did you do that? I don't understand. This doesn't make sense. I haven't been struck down either, but I've been a couple of those other things. And it is when there is nothing left in us that our weaknesses show us how human we are, how frail we are, how undeserving we are, that God can work through us for his glory. It is through God's strength that we endure the hardships of life and overcome our own obstacles and far surpass the expectations of man. So I'm going to add in a little thing really quickly that I didn't ask him if I could talk about, but I'm sure he's going to be okay. So Jude, his last name is Carosello, as you all know, which when you're talking about Jewish boys, not a typical Jewish last name. And there have been times since he felt called into ministry where he's like, what are people going to say when I say I'm Rabbi Jude Carosello? He goes, you know, because it's like not Greenberg or Rosenberg or Lowenstein or, you know, Schrippelwitz or whatever. And he goes, what if they don't think I'm Jewish? And, you know, I didn't grow up with parents who went to the Orthodox synagogue. And I didn't grow up going to the deli in New York City. And I don't have, like, Jewish headstones in my family and things. And he didn't have the right stuff, air quotes. And I said, but God knows that. I said, if he had wanted you to be Jude Greenberg from New York City, who grew up first, you know, first thing in your mouth was a piece of rye bread or whatever, I said, that would have happened. He would have made you that. But he didn't. So that's not what he wanted for you. But he called you into ministry, so that's what he wanted. But he wanted you to be Jude Carosello from Italian parents with pasta, not rye bread. And that's what he made you. And that's perfect for what he's calling you to do. And it may not make sense to you because it really doesn't make a hill of beans sense. But that's what he wanted. Now, that being said, what doesn't make sense to us, if we continue to let that be something that is a stumbling block, the enemy will use that. This is totally not off my notes, so I just feel to go down this way. So if your personal thing is you don't feel like you're a good speaker, or you don't feel like you're spiritual enough, or you don't feel like you're patient enough, okay? And if you do not release that, then the enemy will come in and that will be your Achilles heel. Okay? You know how, like, if you have sports injuries, right, you favor that area of your body that's been injured. And I only say this not from personal experience because my biggest sport is walking. So, but if you have an injury, right, let's say, you know, I blew out my shin or something. Well, oh no, this is from Karate Kid. So, right? Karate Kid, did you guys all see Karate Kid? Okay, so Karate Kid, the mean karate master, right? He tells his guy who's in a karate match with the good karate guy, he tells him, sweep the leg, because he already had an injury on his leg. So he wants him to go in and kick his leg out, basically hit his bad leg, because he knows that if he hits that area that's already weak, what's it going to do? Take him out. Right? So the guy's like, really? Because that's kind of unsportsmanlike. I mean, he doesn't say that, but that's what's said in the look. And the guy's like, yeah. So he does it, and sure enough, the kid goes down. Well, that's what the enemy does. If there's an area that you feel inadequate in, and God has already told you it doesn't matter, but you continue to believe that that's an inadequacy, the enemy is going to come and attack you at that spot. Okay? So, this past couple of weeks, our congregation got IMCS membership. Yay! So if you look on the IAMCS website, you'll see our congregation is one of the member congregations. And Jude was interviewed to go into the ordination program for IAMCS ordination. And their program, I'm going to sit down for a second. Their program is, it's a two-year program, and they evaluate you first and decide to let you in, and then they basically spend 2 years just kind of keeping an eye on you, making sure you're not really wacky and weird. And then after 2 years, you've given your full ordination. So he was interviewed. The interview went really well, and he knows probably like half the people on the steering committee. And it was like, we thought it was a done deal. So he was supposed to hear, like, he went for the interview on a Tuesday. The steering committee was meeting on a Friday, and he was supposed to hear from the guy that's his contact on the steering committee on, like, Monday or Tuesday. So he gets an email, and the email says, "We've accepted your congregation." Okay, that's all good. "And we've decided to accept you into the interim program. However, there are questions about your Jewishness. And so we need to get more information from you before we decide whether we will let you be a Messianic pastor or a Messianic rabbi." And he was like everything just shriveled up, like, because that was his Achilles heel. That was his thing. "I'm not Jude Greenberg. I don't have the standard Jewish pedigree. People are going to question whether I'm Jewish or not." And boom, there it was. And he was just like, "Oh my gosh, what am I doing? I don't know." And so he recovered and he sent away all of his information. "This is how I'm Jewish, and this is why." And really what it is it's a lack of education within the older, all the Greenbergs and stuff. They don't understand about Italian Jewry and even a lot of the crypto-Judaism, all that stuff. They haven't really come in contact with it much. So they didn't understand about it. So he had to send them a page telling about it and other documentation. And then he had to wait. And then the guy got back with him, and they did accept him in for the Messianic rabbi thing. But the guy said just this really cryptic one line about how his situation sparked debate within the steering committee. And he was like, "What are they debating about? I don't really understand. What was it?" I was like, "I don't know." I said, "Maybe it just got them talking about, you know, their ideas of what Jewish is versus the reality of what Jewish is, and how, you know, more and more, especially in our generation, we have people that aren't coming from straight up Jewish households. They're intermarried, and their Judaism is a lot more latent. You know, you had their parents that got married, or their parents' parents that intermarried, and so they're Jewish, but they never grew up as Jewish. And so this is something that the movement is facing as a whole, and God used Jude to bring it to the forefront with the steering committee, which wasn't comfortable for him at all. But it was God's purpose. So, I mean, he came to see that eventually, but it didn't make any sense to him. And this is another thing that Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 1:19 through 20. "For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world?" And verse 25. "For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Messiah Yeshua, who has become for us wisdom, from God, that is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts in the Lord." I mean, it can't be any clearer. This was one of the verses that God gave me specifically, that Not many of you were wise. Not many of you were influential. You didn't come from noble birth, but God chose us because our lack of ability is what makes us perfect. Because then it's very clear that it is God who does it and not us. Because if you come in with a plan and you got your stuff together and you know all the this and the that and the other, well, then it's you. People can easily look at it and go, of course they did that. They're trained in that. So God doesn't pick the person that makes sense. He specializes in using the broken and the unexpected. So what does all of this mean? And this is the word that I heard from the Lord. We must stop listening to the voices that tell us we are less than, not worthy, not ready, not able, not equipped. God's purpose doesn't wait for that. We do not live by the world's standards. We must only judge ourselves by God's standard. And what is his standard? 1 Samuel 16:7. Talk about a great man of God, but when Samuel first sees him, he's the most unlikely David. Most unlikely, the youngest son. The Lord said to Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him." He's talking about the older brother. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So that's the first thing. Is our heart willing? Is our heart willing to do what God is asking us to do, no matter how inadequate we feel? And our faith is the other thing. Hebrews 11, 1 and 2, that's the faith chapter. Jude talked about it today. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. And going down to verse 32, and what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. He's gone all through talking about all these great men who had faith and women who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies through faith, not through their abilities, not through their capabilities, not through their talents, through their faith. So we cannot miss this unique calling for us as individuals because we deem ourselves unworthy or unfit according to the world's standards. 1 Corinthians 3:19, for the wisdom of this world is foolishness in God's sight. So this message, I don't know how this ties into the theme for next weekend, which is renew, but this is the message that God gave me. So what I wanted to leave with you all is that we all have inadequacies. And each one of you sitting here today has something that is keeping you from stepping out into what God is calling you to do. And maybe he's already given you that call. Maybe that's something that he's told you he wants to do. That next step, it may not be a long-term thing. It may be just the next step that he wants you to take in your walk. And you've rejected that because you feel inadequate in some way.